Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have a special episode, an interview for you, on new revelations about the Inslaw Promise Software cold case scandal. The Inslaw affair, as it's referred to, involved efforts by the United States government to conduct covert surveillance of countries and targeted individuals by means of the advanced Promise software. Journalist Danny Casolaro, who deeply researched the case, died under mysterious circumstances when he was about to reveal his bombshell findings on the trail of global government corruption that he called the Octopus. Many of his informants ended up dead or missing as well. The compelling revelations by someone who had two chance encounters with Casolaro at events in Virginia shortly before his death open up a new trail of discovery. During these encounters, Casolaro indicated something was wrong with the intense reaction by the U.S. Justice Department in the Inslaw affair case. These revelations dovetail with information Dr. Joseph Farrell came across that strongly suggests someone had already built a backdoor into the Promise software before it was stolen by the Justice Department and seeded throughout the financial, legal, and national security apparatus of allies and enemies across the globe, meaning that some other group, an unseen actor, has been conducting a worldwide blackmail campaign. The source for today's Casolaro revelations regarding his meeting with the doomed reporter is Marty Farrell, Dr. Farrell's cousin. We'll meet Marty today, and he'll put on the record for the first time the fascinating comments Casolaro made in their brief encounters. We'll go deep with Dr. Farrell on the blockbuster break in the 30-year-old Promise software case that may have staggering implications for what the deep state is attempting for global control. Please join us now. Well, Marty, it's great to have you here. I'm going to have you introduce yourself to our viewers now, just to give us an idea. We know that you're Dr. Farrell's cousin. Is there anything else you want to put on the record in your bio?
Well, I've had multiple jobs in my career.
Don't forget to throw in your dad's job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my dad's job of 25-plus years was Smithsonian Institution. In the Red Castle building right off Jefferson Davis Highway.
Oh, yeah.
So it kind of led me down some rabbit holes very early in my age. Needless to say, he had a lot to do with my inquisitive mind, I think, and put a lot of questions in my life early. Yeah. Only in his connection was with the International Educational Agency or something like that, very early in his career.
Yep.
It's so interesting. So many mysteries around the Smithsonian, of course. he sounds like a very interesting guy.
I remember him, Daniel, when I was a boy, we went out to D.C. to visit Uncle Bob and Marty. And, he and I were... We're just months apart in terms of our birthday, so we're the same age.
Okay.
And we went out there, and Uncle Bob, I remember he had just started working in the Red Castle, and I remember him taking us into that building through these weird doors that nobody ever used. He was opening his, keys and everything. So we got to see some passageways in the Smithsonian that most people don't get to see. It was kind of fun, it was kind of cool.
Yes, it was.
Anyway.
Somewhere along the line, Marty, you got to meet, you had a chance encounter at first with the journalist Danny Casolaro of Octopus fame and all the interesting, fascinating things that he brought forward about Promise software and other pieces of the puzzle there around the deep state. How did you meet him?
Well, it was at a ski chalet sale in Arlington, Virginia. Ski Chalet puts on these promotions every single year, and they're usually pretty big shindigs, to the point where cars are going out into the street and things like that. And he just happened to be in the sale. He was there, walking through the crowd and talking to people because, he was an outgoing kind of guy. That was his kind of demeanor. And it just so happens on the ski wall where I was selling skis, he was talking to somebody about BCCI.
Boom. Oh, wow.
My ear went like yeah. that because I was like, you know, I didn't really know about that banking institution back then, but I had heard rumors about it mm-hmm. and it caught my interest, especially since I was looking into Western goals and stuff like that back mm-hmm. there in that time. And, you know, somebody said something about going to get some beers. And I said, I would love a Budweiser or something like that about that time. And he goes, well, let's go get some Budweisers. And lo and behold, that's what we did. We went to Sir Walter Raleigh's Steakhouse, which was right around the corner, and had a beer. And I had I can't remember what he had, but I will tell you that he had something with him, which is this brown accordion file.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. And it had manila envelopes in it with names and dates and addresses, you know, all kinds.
Whoa. Yeah. Wait a minute here. Number one, how long did you talk? And number two, you actually got a look at sort of.
He had him with him.
Fascinating.
A look inside that thing?
No, I didn't get to see, you know, he delegated out a couple of files and I didn't get to see any of the stuff, but, right. And like I said, it was like a 25, 30 minute dinner quick. He was more interested in looking at stuff for himself, looked mm-hmm. like, than paying mm-hmm. attention to me, mm-hmm. but I was interested in him definitely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, He kept saying that this is something isn't right with this ordeal that I'm going at. I'm looking at, and I kept asking him, "What is it? What's this ordeal?" And you know, he said, "Promise."
Holy cow.
I remember promise.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Prosecutor's Management Information Systems," mm-hmm. and that stuck in my mind, mm-hmm. And he goes, it's not making sense that, you know, this is such a big deal for the DOJ.
Right.
It's not making sense.
Did he review the story with you at that time, or was that the subsequent meeting?
That was the subsequent meeting in when we had beers. The first meeting was 1989.
Okay.
And he didn't have very much then, just had a bunch of, you know, conglomeration of stuff. And it didn't look like he was really interested in talking to me. He's more interested in drinking his beers and going through the stuff. And then the next year in 1990 is when we sat down and had beers and we kind of discussed a lot of the stuff.
Okay.
So he was far along his way at that point.
So at that second meeting, and he's saying that something is not adding up, but he was genuinely mystified.
Yes, wow. Mystified.
Did he have the case with him the second time around?
No, he did not. He did not have his case with him, but I'm assuming that the case was in his car because everybody tells me he didn't go anywhere without that case.
Without that case, right.
This is very interesting. Marty, if you had to go and think of this time-wise, you're saying 89, 90, would you say it was the fall of 89, the summer of 89?
I know exactly the month or the 2 months, August, September.
Okay.
Because that's when Ski Chalet used to have their sales, August and September. Now, 80, I can't remember, was it, you know, August or September in 89 and 90, I can't remember.
So that first meeting is a chance meeting at this skiing encounter. And then you get together, you're talking, he mentions a few things. He has the case with him. He's moving around files and he's talking a little bit about something doesn't add up with what I'm working on. And he mentions promise.
How do you get to a second meeting? What happens? What leads you to meet him a second time?
Before we exited that restaurant, I said, listen, my friend, I need to speak with you again. We need to talk again because I am very interested in what you're pulling down and we need to speak. And I said, I don't care when, where, or what we need to speak. And, you know, lo and behold, it wasn't until the next year, 1990, August, September somewhere, that Ski Chalet has their sale again. And I don't remember if this was in Chantilly at that time or Arlington at that time, but we went out for beers.
Okay. And you go out a second time, you're reconnecting, and what's the conversation like?
Serious.
Yeah.
Dead serious. I mean, he's wandered into a place that he doesn't know where it's going to lead other than, well, he did say, I'm not the kind of guy that will ever kill himself.
Holy cow.
Oh boy.
How long did you guys talk?
25 minutes again, 25, 30. He, you know what? What I recognize, he didn't really talk too much too long with anybody. It was, you know, short interactions, at least with me. That's what it was. And he didn't really know me that well, other than I had the same interests as him. And we were diving down similar rabbit holes at that time.
Right. And he probably was like, you know, there's so few people that were dealing with these things. He was probably relieved to be talking to someone who knew.
Who was interested.
Yeah.
That's where it kind of got serious. The second round was that he was amazed what I knew about, you know, a lot of that stuff. And it was only on my own behalf that I knew it.
When you talked with him and he said that this is not adding up, in reference to promise, did he give any indication to you or give any hints or suggestions or anything that you can read between the lines as to what in his mind was not adding up about the research he'd gathered at the time?
What it kind of appeared to me was is that he couldn't figure out why DOJ was so concerned that this disappeared. He couldn't figure that out because they were using this software long before all of this took place.
Holy cow.
All these agencies were using this software. IRS, FBI, DOJ, all of them. And so why would they, other than nefarious purposes?
Okay, you remember when we talked, I think it's about 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
Whenever it was that you and I talked, I mentioned to you and I mentioned to Daniel, literally within a few minutes after you and I got done talking, Marty, I got on the horn with Daniel and let him know about all of this, that you'd met Casolaro.
Mm-hmm.
And what I told Daniel is something that I told you in our private discussion that I want to mention now that everybody's listening and mention it on the record.
Yeah.
Back in the early 1990s, I read a book, a fictional novel, and I don't remember the author's name, and I don't remember the title. All I remember was it was an octavo-sized paperback book with a white cover, and if I recall correctly, it had the title New World Order, you know, that phrase somewhere in the title.
But we're hunting it down.
Yeah, we're hunting it down, you know, something, you know. But it had that phrase in the title. And part of the book was about the Promise software. And this is where the story when you mentioned that you had met Casolaro and that he was disturbed about something regarding the promised story that he couldn't figure out, it rang the alarm bell, because this book maintained that a programmer, and this is where it gets really weird, and I'm sure Daniel's going to leap in here, a programmer who had been working for Inslaw by the name of Barry Kumnick had supposedly programmed a back door into the Promise software before it ever left Inslaw and was stolen by the Justice Department. So in other words, after the software was stolen and then allegedly farmed around by the DOJ to, you know, Wackenhut and the CIA and all the stuff that Danny uncovered and was uncovering about the time he met you, about, you know, them adding back doors to the software, this book, this fictional book, is maintaining that a back door had been added unbeknownst to the owners of Inslaw before the software was even stolen. And I'll tell you, Marty, what really gets me. When I first mentioned that story, I think it was on George Ann Hughes in the Old Byte Show. I don't even remember where I first mentioned it. Lo and behold, out of the clear blue sky, I get an email from Bill Hamilton, the president of Inslaw.
Wow.
Yeah, asking me, you know, what do I know about this? Where, you know, where did you, and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I told him, you know, it was in this book. That's all I know. And at the time, I still had a copy of the book. And if I remember correctly, I gave him the title of this thing. But it really floored me that he took it seriously enough to email me
right
about it.
So that's this is really fascinating. There's two things I want to mention here.
Uh-huh.
So based on what you just heard, Marty, was it your impression when you talked to Casolaro that he thought that somebody had got to this software and put a back door or interfered with it and changed it before the DOJ stole it? Did that come up at all?
Not directly. It didn't come up directly, but he gave me the impression that something funky was going on beforehand.
Oh, wow.
And here's another interesting thing, and I did not know. What is cryptic AG or crypto AG? What is that?
Okay, so let's pause and say this is a CIA NSA front company dealing with advanced steganography and spying. It's disbanded as of 2018. What did he say?
He mentioned that term?
No, this is something that I just came across. BDN or the... This involves BDN and a lot of the other intelligence agencies, because there was another guy at NSA who ended up gone, who worked at Vint Mill, Virginia.
Oh, holy cow.
Okay. And it was in January of 1991 that he showed up at National Airport in a car all beat up.
What
just popped into my mind is that you may be talking about something having to do with blockchains and cryptocurrencies.
Well, that's
and
what,
if that's
what Stan, that's what this guy Standorf, Alan Standorf,
yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
So there may be, in other words, there may be back doors and all that stuff that have not.
Apparently, he worked.
There's our dark pools and our algorithmic trading.
Yes. Yeah. Very fascinating. I'm going to take you back to the Casolaro meeting.
Sorry, Gus.
No, that's okay.
I think this is going to expand out into what you just mentioned, but I just want to, for the record, get that. You sat down. He mentions he's uneasy about Promise Software, and he wonders why the Justice Department is so hell-bent to cover it up or press this case or whatever it happens to be. Give me a little more of anything you remember just of being there, even if it seems insignificant.
Well, he apparently made a bunch of copies with some guy, you know, and he didn't tell me who the guy was.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go back into stories, it's this guy, Michael and Standorf.
Michael Reconosciuto?
Yeah, it's Standorf.
Oh, yeah.
That are making.
Whoa, Marty. Just let me get this very clear. And anybody out there who's listening and knows the Insaw story knows why I'm going apoplectic here. Because what you're suggesting is that Casolaro had somehow made a connection or knew, or there was a connection directly between Michael Reconosciuto and Alan Standorf of the NSA.
Something like that. That's the impression I got.
Oh, wow.
Holy cow.
So he was getting copies about this?
Well, no, he just said I didn't know who they were.
Right.
I didn't know who. He says, yeah, we just made a bunch of, you know, copies. And I didn't, you know, what am I supposed to think? When
wait a minute. Copies of what? File folder?
Yeah. Folders.
Interesting.
I'm So in other words, Casolaro has this big vanilla folder
what I saw was a dark brown accordion case.
Accordion, okay.
With an accordion with vanilla folder. Files it. That's all I saw. I don't know what he had by the time.
And you're implying that they somebody that Casolaro was in connected with, that he and Casolaro made copies of this accordion folder.
No, that was his personal file. They were just making copies of whatever these two guys were giving him.
I got you.
Okay. Yeah,
right. So let's go back to that. He's saying we're making copies with Michael and this other guy. What else does he say about it?
He says, you know, this stuff that's coming out of this is not making, this is where he's saying it's not making sense to him.
Uh-huh.
You know, these files are pretty extensive. In other words, they have to do with, he said, highly classified information.
Right. And he's nervous at that point.
Oh, very nervous. Very serious. Completely different from the first time I met him.
Interesting. Did you notice anything, like, has his appearance, had it deteriorated? Did he seem like he lost weight or anything?
No. And more so adamant about getting to the bottom of this thing.
I see.
Yeah.
He gives you a hint that he isn't going to commit suicide.
No. That never entered my mind.
What did he say to you about it, though?
I'm not the kind of person that will ever commit suicide.
But that's an interesting thing to just slip into a conversation. How did that come out? Like, were you talking? You mentioned something about copies. He's uneasy about the case.
I'm telling you, whatever you're into, you may be getting in over your head. This is if you're telling me this is how, and you're not, you know, you're getting in over your head. And he can, and you know, that's when he said, I will never kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow.
Unbelievable. Were there any other names that came up?
Videndieks? Peter Videndieks?
Peter Videndieks?
Videndieks, whatever the guy's name. Videndieks. Videndieks, yeah.
What happened? What did he say about him?
Just, he wasn't confident that the guy was on the up and up.
No, he was, yeah. For good reason.
Wow.
So wait a minute, Marty. I got to get this straight in my head because I'm hearing a lot of this the first time too. We didn't talk about this the other night. I'm kind of breathless here. Okay. So you're meeting with Casolaro. He just happens blithely to mention Michael Reconosciuto.
And you got to understand, I don't know this guy.
I understand.
A rabbit hole.
I got that. But anyway, he's mentioning Michael Reconosciuto, Alan Standor, Peter Videndieks, okay? And then, on top of this, this is where I'm confused.
Hey, cuz, he didn't mention Standor.
Oh, okay.
He didn't mention him. He mentioned Michael, but he didn't mention Standor.
Okay. All right. So he's mentioned Michael Reconosciuto and that he and somebody else were making copies.
Mm-hmm.
The copies that he mentioned were, you had the impression that they were of the Promise software program, or were they copies of actual other classified files?
I think they're probably classified other files. That's what I'm, that's, yeah.
Okay.
And they were communications.
Okay. If they were communications, were they using the Promise software to access those files and make the copies? That's, you don't know.
I don't know how they got them. He just said they were there, you know, we made them. I could speculate, but.
I hear you. No, that's good. What's great is when you go back to the meeting, even if you remember little things about him, you know, the way he was presenting himself, if, like you said, he was nervous, and he was talking a little bit. Just anything else that you remember about the meeting?
That his demeanor drastically changed from one year to the next. That's a certainty.
Yeah.
And it wasn't defeatism. He wasn't defeated by any stretch of the imagination. He was on to something. Couldn't figure it out, but was on to something. That was my impression.
Now, the last name you mentioned, that's a tricky name too, but he brought it up. You remembered something about it, and he didn't trust this person.
Right. He apparently had been going through something of this guy's testimony. He'd been going through it, and it wasn't adding up, and it didn't make sense to him. And like I said, this was only 25-30 minutes again. So it was like not very much, but enough for me to go, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's an incredible chance meeting round two, right?
Oh, boy.
Now, just so you're remembering a few things from being around him, he doesn't have the file with him the second time around, but how does he leave it with you the second time around? What does he say?
I came back at him again.
Okay.
I came back at him again and said, listen, we must continue this. You seem very, very uptight this time. I want to see you again. We need to do this again, you know? And it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get the impression that he thought he was being followed?
Yeah. Yeah. He mentioned something about his housemaid, you know, his housekeeper. getting phone calls.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Okay, just out of the blue, either hanging up, stuff like that. But, you know, he didn't. He just mentioned it in passing. It wasn't like that was a part of his conversation with him. He said, you know, it's weird that I get something like that. It's weird that phone call keep not getting much sleep.
Let me go back to this guy that you say that he had been going, that Danny Casolaro had been going through this other guy's testimony. Presumably in connection with the Promise case.
I imagine. I don't know.
Did he mention Peter Vidinick's name in connection with that testimony, or is Vidinick's name not
just the name? Just the name okay. to me. But then when I go back and I look at it after he ends up dead, I go, "Geez,
well." Oh, okay. I got you.
That's one of the names he mentioned.
Yeah.
So. We know he's talking about somebody named Michael, and he's talking about this Peter character. And he says about the Justice Department. That's interesting that he brings it up, and it's like, I don't know why they're so hot on this.
In other words, that's an interesting point, Daniel, because this is the first time I've ever heard this. The idea that Casolaro himself is wondering, what's the big deal? Why is the Justice Department making such a big deal out of this software? That's the very first time I've ever heard this.
Yeah.
In connection with Casolaro and his investigation.
That is really interesting that he himself is mystified at the reaction.
Well, that's what makes me think that there's something to this story, that there was a backdoor added before anybody else knew about it and before anybody else had done so. If that's the case, if you're selling software, if you're the CIA and you've had Michael Reconosciuto and Wackenhut modify and add all these backdoors to the software that you then allow to be stolen in some cases by the Soviet Union, or you sell cheap to the West German intelligence service and so on, and then you discover that someone else besides you has a back door and it's out there and they've got access to all this stuff, then the Justice Department hits the panic button.
These are the indications, because what's fascinating is the fundamentalist Christian novel suggesting it.
Right.
That there's this fictional in the book, but nonetheless, we know referring possibly to a real person.
To a real person.
And the name on that, Barry Kumnick, there's a lot of confusion online about this person as an actual person versus a character in that book, which I also find interesting.
Yeah.
But in any case, Kumnick is supposedly the person who places the backdoor in the Promise software before the Justice Department steals it.
Right.
And if that's the case, then what you're suggesting, Joseph, and what this kind of confusion around Casolaro's mind when he meets Marty, those kind of answer each other. Because if the Justice Department figures out after it's spread this software to these different countries intentionally and even allies, then it realizes, oh, somebody's watching us.
Right.
Because there's already a backdoor inside of it. That is... You know, that makes so much sense with what we're looking at. If you look at right after the fact, you go into 9/11, you go into the financial coup, and you go into this massive worldwide hacking going along, even to the arrest of Assange. You're looking at a whole field that they're trying to get their hands back on and put the genie back in the bottle.
In the bottle, right.
Well, you know who's an interesting player in all of these events?
Who?
William P. Barr.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy that closed the case down on this thing.
Right.
Yep. Right. That's right.
Excellent point.
And he's the guy that's connected to the whole MENA business and, you know, courtesy of Terry Reed and his book Compromised.
The New Covenant, cuz.
Yeah, the New Covenant. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Do you... Marty, when you left Casolaro, going back again, 1990 now, we're in that same period of time, August, September, is the last time you see him.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have his phone number at that point? How do you end it? How do you end the conversation?
We're gonna see each other at the next ski chalet sale.
Okay.
That's where we met. We met at the sales. And he met me at the sale the second year. We went out and had beers. And that's where we're gonna meet again. I don't know where the sale was gonna be at that time, but wherever it was, we were gonna meet there. But, you know, never made it to the end of August.
Right. Exactly. Do you, if you can go back to the first meeting for me again, because we were talking a little bit before I even started recording about that first meeting and Larry McDonald, and you hear him talking about BCCI and these interesting things. So I'm just going to re-ask that. So forgive me for doing this. But Marty, can you remember that first encounter with Casolaro?
Not directly, other than the fact that I turned to the ski wall and there was this guy that was about my height, blonde hair, outspoken, talking to another person about that bank.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately drew me to him. And I kind of just hung off to the side of his shoulder. And when he got done, I just said, I can't help overhear what you were talking about. I work here as a rep, but it's not who I am, but you're talking to my business and I'd love to talk to you. That's how it was started.
Interesting. Absolutely fascinating. And somewhere in that conversation, he was talking about BCCI and that perked up your ears a little bit.
Yep. And frankly, I didn't ever get back to that. Until we got to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
That was right about the time that the whole BCCI story had broken in the news.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been right about that
period. Time. Yeah. Yeah. Marty, do you remember him making any predictions about this is going to blow things sky high or anything like that?
Oh, he was adamant that this is a thriller beyond Manila. I mean, mm-hmm. this was something very, very big and had a lot of big names and a lot of big business involved.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, he said he was saying that this was going to take him to a different level.
Did he ever mention any government officials' names?
Other than Hamilton, you know, other than Hamilton, that's the only official he said, because that's
what did he say about Hamilton? I assume you're talking about Bill Hamilton.
Bill Hamilton. He said that these are the people that actually started the software program.
Right.
When Promise went in my ear, I wanted to know more about it, and that's what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Did he ever indicate that he was contacted by the Hamiltons directly to look into all of this, and that part of the reason why he was doing all, did he ever intimate any of that?
I can't, because for the life of me, I can't figure out mm-hmm. if it was him that went after Bill or Bill that went after him. Yeah. Okay. I can't remember. Nor do I think that he ever said anything.
That's an interesting way of putting it, because usually the way that the story is presented by people who've researched Casolaro and his association with the Promise story is that he was contacted by the Hamiltons.
See, I didn't. I wasn't
he didn't
privy
give that. Interesting.
Yeah, I wasn't privy.
Did he mention military, anything about the military or anything about intelligence services like the NSA?
Well, when he mentioned Bill, he said Bill used to work for these NSA, guys, or right. Yeah. Worked for him. That's it. But no military ever got involved.
Did the name Wackenhut come up?
No. But that name did come up after the fact for me, because I went to work for DHS back in 2002, and Wackenhut was a name that I kind of ran into.
Oh yeah, that's one heck of a job, I can imagine. That's absolutely fascinating. And Joseph, you want to spin around now and talk about how the crypto part of that caught your attention?
Well, the crypto part catches my attention, Danny Castle.
Yeah, right. We're talking about Danny.
Yeah, you're not that one. The reason why is that we know that shortly after 9/11, the West German BND, the German intelligence service, got rid of all of their promised software. Now, why they chose to wait that long and choose a post 9/11 date for it. But here's what I'm thinking. As I mentioned to you before we started the recording, it looks to me, Daniel and Marty, as if the Promise software, which is a multilingual computer software, in other words, it can read in other computer languages and tabulate and assemble databases regardless of what the language that the database is written in, okay? It's an immensely sophisticated program, especially for back then.
Yes.
So what that tells me is if we're, and let's remember that the recent case, I think it was 2005 or 2006, they arrested that Chinese spy in Arizona for trying to steal secrets from Sandia Laboratories. Well, the guy went on to admit that he had been using the Promise software to do all of
this. Oh, right.
So here, that tells me that you're dealing with a software that's spread all over the world. It's in use in all of these classified installations, and it's gone through several iterations. And if it allows you to pull databases from a variety of languages, it's also the perfect software to use in banks and for things like algorithmic trading. And here comes the big one. It's a perfect software to use in cryptocurrencies.
Oh, yeah.
And run mining operations.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Now, that would be the modern 2022 iteration of this.
That would be the 2022 iteration of a software program that's been out there since the late 1970s, early 1980s. So in other words, the problem here is that what I'm seeing is we know the Casolaro story. Casolaro basically uncovered a law, and Michael Reconosciuto, you know, God bless him, gave his affidavits as part of the court record that, yes, he was part of a team hired by the CIA through the Wackenhut Corporation to go in and add back doors to this software.
Right.
And the software, in turn, was seeded by the Reagan administration, and in some cases, they allowed the Soviets to steal copies of it.
Right.
You know, so that they can shut down the Soviet Union at the press of a button.
Right.
They do all of this, but unfortunately, they go on to learn that before it ever gets into their hands, before they steal it from Inslaw, somebody, unbeknownst to Inslaw itself, has put in a back door.
That's it. Yeah. This is the key point.
That's the key point.
And what I get from Marty, from your recollection of meeting Casolaro, is he has that same wondering about this, like, why are they freaking out to this level?
Yeah.
And Reconosciuto provided that to the House Intelligence Committee.
He certainly did.
Yeah. And shortly after that, he got arrested for running a meth lab. He gets stuck in prison for 17 years.
Oh, they let imagine him out. That. Guess what?
and by the way, Reconosciuto is the guy that helps work on things like fuel air bombs and adapting nuclear triggers for nuclear weapons to the use of fuel air bombs. And it's Michael Reconosciuto, by the way, that Ted Gunderson interviews after the Oklahoma City bombing, and it's Reconosciuto that says, no, that's a fuel air bomb.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So well, they must have loved him.
They
must have
just loved him. They
Marty, I'm just going to take you back to the time period one last time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's after you hear the news that Castellaro is dead. And they're saying it's suicide, and you're thinking back to the conversations and these chance meetings with him. What are you hearing, and what are you feeling at that point?
I'm immediately red pilled. Okay, I'm immediately that red pilled me for life. That whole thing. I was going down rabbit holes before that, just in college, you know, but they weren't. They weren't big. It was, you know, Mina and that kind of stuff when I was in college. But this red-pilled me for life. I mean, I couldn't get it out of my head. I knew he didn't commit suicide. I knew that something fishy had gone on.
Well, his file, I mean, that big file, accordion file that you saw him carrying, it's never gone. Been confirmed. It's gone. Yeah.
And he's reputed to have carried that with him everywhere.
Everywhere.
Do you guys know that the Freedom of Information Act has been applied to the Martinsburg Police Department every single year, over and over again, probably three or four times a year, for the information on this case?
Uh-huh.
And it is yet to be released.
I can believe it.
It's unbelievable. They skipped the autopsy and buried the body without the family's permission. I mean, they had it cremated.
One of the detectives on the cases was the chief of police, ended up as being the chief of police of Martinsburg for a while.
Uh-huh.
No fiction there.
And I believe that the medical examiner was no other than... what was his name again? I can't think of
it. Oh, I know who you're talking about.
Bodden.
Yeah.
Right.
Dr. Michael Bodden, who became very famous after all that.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. This guy goes all the way back to the House Assassination Committees in the 70s. Right. And he's like, oh, no, you know, the magic bullet's the real thing. And
yeah.
Guy. And then he gets his own HBO special. How do you like that? That's pretty good. Joseph, if you play ball with the establishment, not bad, huh?
I have to ask you another question, Marty.
Okay.
Because I'm hearing stuff way beyond what we were talking about the other night when we were talking about all this. When you were talking with Castellaro, did he ever give you the impression or just come right out and say where he had been traveling?
No, he didn't give me any indications of his schedule or his, you know, his operations, other than the fact that he needed to interview a bunch of people. Right. You know, he needed to find out, you know, what these people had to do with this, what this guy had to do with that.
Right. Okay. So he indicated that he traveled a lot, but he was very cautious about giving out any specific details of where and when he was going to be. Yeah.
He wasn't giving me very much, you know, even though I was prodding him, it wasn't like he was willing to give me everything he knew. And that's why I was so interested in him. And I wanted to keep coming back. I knew that this guy was on to something. And, you know, I was more persistent with him than he was with me.
Right.
You had these one-on-one conversations. Were there other people just from the event and stuff who were with you? And was he mixing it up generally when you had these conversations?
Well, he had mixed it up all during the ski sale, probably for about an hour or so. I reckon I'm pretty good with faces, and I saw him make his way around the for about an hour before I introduced myself.
When he was mixing and mingling, was he talking with a lot of people?
Yeah, it looked like it. I mean, you know, he's talking with, like, it even looked like he knew a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
And
I only participated. I didn't really get to know very many of the Ski Chalet staff. I don't know if any of them ever knew Danny. You know, Danny frequented Arlington area quite a bit. You know, that's Fairfax was his rolling ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. The comments about his, housemaid taking weird calls is interesting as well. So that seemed to kind of unnerve him a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was there at this. Was it your impression that he was there at the Ski Chalet show because a lot of the Washington elite attended that show?
That's kind of what I got. Yeah. That's kind of what I got. Yeah. He was more there to see who was there, I think. That's right. The impression I got.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
And perhaps also to meet a contact or somebody in a setting that would not be all that suspicious.
Very, very possible, because, you know, so many of these questions ran through my head after.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But it's like, we're not thinking of him so much as a ski enthusiast, as this is a good way for him to network.
For him to, to operate.
Wow. This is absolutely fascinating, because when we look at the trail of Hamilton making that software after having a career at the NSA, already we know that the stuff is very advanced, probably based on the fact that he was working at the NSA all the way back to the 60s.
Right.
When he reaches out to you, Joseph, it's in relation to the fact that you're blogging about this Christian fundamentalist book that mentions.
Yeah, I wouldn't say blogging, but somehow I was putting out that information publicly.
Right.
And, you know, I don't remember where it was, if it was a blog, if it was on George Ann Hughes' show, but I do remember putting it out there. And he contacted me because apparently he had heard or read what I said and somehow tracked me down, because I get this email directly from him. And in fact, when he told me who he was, I asked for, I emailed back and basically says, how do I know you are who you say you are?
Right. Yeah. Right. And how do I even know that you're Bill Hamilton?
Yeah. He assured me that he was, he gave me some information and so on. So that's when I responded that, I'm getting this information from a book. This is the author's name, the title, the ISBN number. I remember it being white. I remember it being about an inch thick, octavo size, 6x9 paperback size. But that's all that's all the information I had. And he was clearly interested in knowing if I had more information about that guy. And if so, where was he? And I had to tell him, no, I don't know anything about him. I've never had any contact with him. It was after that that I, just like you, I started looking online. And, yeah, there does appear to have been a Barry Kumnick.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd name.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's not, as far as I can tell, a name that's associated with programming in all of its iterations, but you never know.
Right.
So it's a strange story. And that was not the last time that Mr. Hamilton contacted me. He contacted me again a few years later. If I remember correctly, my mind is kind of like Marty's. I'm going on memories of things. And, well, you know,
you're both doing a good job with it.
Well, when these things happen to you, you don't realize
that. No, you have no idea.
Yeah, you're on the periphery of something, you know, huge.
You're right.
But he did contact me later, and I forget what it was for. I think it was to relay some information and see if I'd heard anything in addition to that. And again, I had to say no. But this is certainly new.
Yeah.
You know, hearing all of this, that Castle Lake, what's new here and that really grabs me, Daniel, is, okay, Marty met Casolaro, and Casolaro is looking at this whole promised story, and it's not making sense to him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all new.
Yeah.
Because it's Casolaro that basically uncovered this whole mess. We wouldn't be talking about it to this day if it wasn't for what he did. And if it's not making sense to Casolaro, then there's an aspect of the story that Casolaro himself, who uncovered all these details, there's an aspect in all these details not making sense to him. And the only thing that I can think of is, yeah, maybe the back door was added, the original one, long before the Department of Justice stole it. And if that's the case,
yes,
somebody has everybody over a pickle barrel.
Exactly.
And it ain't the U.S. government, folks.
Right. It's this extra.
It's whoever it is.
Whoever it is.
Yeah.
Well, let's go into that a little bit, because I get the impression when Hamilton writes to you, and what you've put out there rings a bell with him. And again, you're reading this Christian fundamentalist novel, and in the middle of it, there's all this information about Inslaw that's mm-hmm. inserted in there, and mm-hmm. this character, Barry Cumnick.
Now, I'll go, let me interrupt you.
Yes.
In the novel, whoever it was that wrote this dang thing, in the novel, Barry Cumnick basically disappears after inserting the back door.
Right.
He just drops off the grid and is using this back door to cloak his movements and so on. Basically, in other words, he is set for life. He's become the Robert Vesco of the programming world.
You know? Hanging out in the hot zone.
Yeah, hanging out in the hot zone, you know, talking to Fidel, who knows. But yeah, it's a bizarre novel. You know, he goes to all this trouble just to drop out, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's a weird novel. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I had to.
No, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Here's what I'm thinking about this. I get the impression Hamilton, when I've read Hamilton's statements about this, he is also a little bit bewildered by the extent to which he's prosecuted for trying to sue the government, after all, for stealing his software.
For stealing his software, right.
Absolutely. And Elliot Richardson.
I know.
Attorney General.
Yeah.
But he's also Hamilton's lawyer.
Right.
Exactly. And this is fascinating because he's involved in the Special Intel Committee looking into this. Mm-hmm. And what he says is, if I get this right, this is makes Watergate look like a walk in the park. And of course, mm-hmm. he was the attorney general who resigned under Watergate. He would know. That's a huge statement on the record by a very hefty government official.
Yeah.
So he was convinced just by what he saw in the committee. So he's convinced Hamilton also, as I've said in his public statements, didn't realize, you know, what he was getting himself into dealing with this. But it seems to me they all had a question mark. Casolaro, Richardson, and Hamilton is right at the heart of it. They're wondering. And him reaching out to you and what you found there in that novel about the idea that somebody had placed a backdoor in it before it had been stolen, it explains a lot and would answer a lot of those questions. And that's why it rang a bell for him.
Right. Now let's go further. Let's talk about some other software.
Right.
Let's talk about Hamilton Securities and Catherine Austin Fitz.
Right.
And her place-based software that she developed for Hamilton Securities. Would that kind of software be of interest to the government? Yes.
Yeah.
Would you attempt, if you were the government, to put a back door in said software? Yes. Mm-hmm. Who's the judge that handled her case? Why, it was Judge Nicholas Bua.
The same judge that
handled the Promise case.
That is unbelievable.
Appointed by Barr.
Absolutely remarkable information. Stay right there, gentlemen, and we'll do another hour bringing out the deep implications surrounding this break in the Promise Software case and how it reverberates today in the efforts to enact emergency powers through the Continuity of Government COG program. We'll also take a deep look at Casolaro's investigation into the UFO file and how the key source for Casolaro, genius software programmer Michael Riconosciuto, also is connected to UFO investigations through his father's business partner, Fred Crisman, involved in the Maury Island UFO case. Now, part two will be available at darkjournalist.com in the next 24 hours. Of course, you can find Dr. Farrell's work at GizaDeathStar.com. Please join us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. live for the X series. See you soon.